Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as always, is the Rollo Tomasi of my life, James. Before we get started, you can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We have many, many podcasts, almost 300 podcasts that you can check out. A good one to check out this time might be episode 189, which is our Silence of the Lambs podcast, which is very good. And Jonathan Demme passed away last week, and he was a wonderfully talented director, and that's his finest hour. So I would recommend listening to that if you need an old podcast in your life. But yeah, also
that was a good one.
That was a fantastic podcast. Well, it's good because the movie surprised us with how good it was. It's like top to bottom one of my favorite, like best directed movies ever. Like it's up there with The Social Network for me and The Master and a variety of other favorites. And it just sort of, it caught us both by surprise. So that whole podcast is us being like, this movie's so good, you know, and then also breaking down why it's good, because there's so many good little details in that movie that make it as good as it is. And that's why it is a classic and continues. Well, I mean, you can be a perfectly directed movie and not be a classic because nobody saw it. But that's a movie that actually people saw and is actually fantastic and won Best Picture and was actually the best movie of the year. But anyway, that's on our website, MacGuffinMen.com. You can follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Men. And our most recent podcast was on The General, a 1926 Buster Keaton film. So yeah, you can check all of those out. And we'll start talking about this movie.
Welcome to The MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James, I teased our current subject as this movie. What is this movie?
And you said Rollo Tomasi.
I did, yeah.
This movie that we're talking about this week is L.A. Confidential.
Yes.
Starring Rollo Tomasi. No.
starring basically everybody but Rollo Tomasi. There's a million parts in this movie.
So I saw this movie a long time ago for the first time, and I've always really liked it. I saw it. I mean, too young for several reasons, but too young to appreciate how good this movie is, because I truly do enjoy it quite a lot. But it never really clicked with me how Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe weren't really famous people at this time, because I didn't really know who was famous when I saw this movie. But yeah, it's absolutely stacked cast. Even some smaller characters have some good people behind them.
Yeah, I mean, the cast list in this movie is pretty impressive. Like even one of the good actors from CSI plays Mickey Cohen for like 5 seconds in this movie at the beginning. David Strathairn, I think, has like 2 scenes. So Cromwell, obviously.
Jimmy Croms.
Yeah. Yeah. The only negative thing I can say about his performance is that his accent obscures the beautiful Cromwellian voice that we've all come to know and love.
Right. Yeah, but his accent allows some of the lines to be improved slightly. But we'll get there, I'm sure.
Yeah. But yeah, this movie is the beginning of Russell Crowe movie star. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Guy Pearce movie star in a big way, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would say Guy Pearce, known actor. I don't think he ever became a movie star, whereas Russell Crowe definitely did. Yeah.
Yeah. This is what gets him to his... sets him on to his career peak, we'll say.
Yeah, for sure. And also Guy Pearce has been pretty open in interviews about how he's never really he's a pretty happy living a middle class lifestyle and never really wanted to work all that much. He basically does one movie a year to keep the money coming in, and then goes and hides in a ranch or wherever he lives, you know. So whereas Russell Crowe acted way more after this movie. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Does this movie feel like a period piece to you? I mean, it's 1953. It's a 1997 movie, but it's set in 1953, I believe. Mm-hmm. Does it feel like a period piece movie? Because you and I have never really talked a ton about this movie. And I've seen it several times, and I didn't even know how... I know you had seen it, but I didn't really know your feelings on it. But I know you're not a huge period piece guy, so I didn't know where you'd land on this.
Well, this movie, this movie still looks like a period piece to me, but it looks like a period piece in the way 90s cop movies look like a period piece, which seems to be a part of the, I mean, because now we're 20 years away from this movie's initial release, and so it just looks like a movie from the 90s, so it looks like a period piece in that way, just in the way that every movie looks like a period piece for the period it was made. But yeah, you are right that it's not it's not really trying to replicate 1950s filmmaking in any way. And I believe that was director Curtis Hanson's instruction to most of the crew, is that he wanted this movie to be a period piece that didn't look like a period piece. And that is actually, that's something that drives me crazy about period pieces, is that they feel the need to, or about other period pieces, not LA Confidential, is that they feel the need to replicate the style of filmmaking that existed in that period. That's a reason why I liked Michael Mann's Public Enemies, which is a movie that took place in the late 20s, I think, or early 30s, but looked like a movie that was made in 2009, and like a very progressive progressive movie for 2009 visually.
Digital.
Yeah, exactly. and that's something I always appreciate, because it just feels like it feels like you're being treated like an idiot when a filmmaker's like, oh, we're making this movie about the 1950s. We have to shoot it in the style that John Huston would have shot it, due to all of the various limitations that existed in the 1950s.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that, you know.
Yeah, and I think you're right that it was a conscious choice. I've seen Curtis Hanson talk about that, and saying, you know, he did want this to be period accurate. He did want this to, you know, not be anachronistic, not to have vehicles or things that didn't exist around that time or wouldn't be in LA at that point. But he said, I want the period detail to be in the background and the characters in the foreground. And, you know, I think that kind of touches on what you're saying about certain period movies that, and I understand it from a filmmaker's perspective, you know, you put all this energy into researching these things, into finding these things. I think there is the temptation to put it in the foreground just to really show off, you know, all the work that you did and exactly how period accurate you're being. But I always find that detracts from the story or the characters. And I think that this was a very conscious choice to not do that, you know, to have things be accurate, but to be still character and story focused in your filmmaking. And that's something that I think works so well. I mean, there's parts where I just kind of forget this is in the 50s, because it seems, you know, there still is the language, there still is the you know, the sets that look like the 1950s, but it doesn't play off like a movie that constantly reminds you of how much work they put into making this seem like it's the 1950s, right?
Yeah, I would agree. Lots of Steadicam in this movie, which didn't exist until the 70s, so.
Right.
Yeah.
And
so
I think that's one notable
departure, is all I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. And I kind of feel the same way about the noir aspects of this movie. I mean, you can make a checklist of things that make a movie a noir and compare it to this movie, and a lot of the things are there, but as you said, it's not like they're trying to make this movie as though it was being made in that time, just that it takes place in this time.
Yeah.
There's certainly noir elements, but visually, we're not getting a ton of the shadows and a ton of the weird angles. They're certainly there, but it's not all over the place. Again, I just don't find it front and center or being kind of rammed down your throats and used sparingly and well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are no shots of like the you know, dark silhouette shadows and on the splashing along the sides or along the walls of the scene or anything like that, which is something that you see constantly in noir movies, you know. That's like notable thing that doesn't exist in this movie.
So, I mean, visually and structurally and thematically, how noir do you find this?
I mean, it's still noir to me, in that the first 90 minutes to 110 minutes are just information, and then the last 10 minutes are people rapidly piecing all of that together, and it generally not having, you know, a nice tight bow of happiness on the end of it, you know, and that is sort of the noir element that I feel continues to run through this movie. You know, there's just so much information being given out, and the way that it is resolved very quickly and seemingly like way too fast, but that's always the way it happens in noir movies, that's the thing in this movie that reminds me the most of classic noirs, like The Maltese Falcon. I think everything gets resolved in the last 90 seconds, you know, like it's so crazy how quickly that movie wraps up, and that's like one of the you know, the most notable noir movies there are. Yeah. And that's something that I remember, like, the second time viewing this movie, I kept an eye on where I was in the movie time-wise. And, like, with 10 minutes left, I was like, there's no way there's only 10 minutes left. They have so much left to accomplish, you know? And, yeah, so that's sort of a noir staple to me.
Yeah. I mean, as far as noir staples are concerned, you kind of touched on it by saying it's just information. It's an intricate plot. It's kind of a labyrinth, you know? There's the cover-ups and the deceit and framing and issues of identity and a femme fatale. A lot of these noir staples do find their way in. You know, I feel the version of L.A. Confidential that leans harder on it, I still think I like it. You know, I think if this was in black and white and had those long shadows that we talked about and more of the you know, blinds or jail bar shadows showing people trapped, I still think I love this movie, but I do appreciate that they didn't lean on those things too hard and kept all those things in the story and thematic, but without having it kind of go through the noir filter in order to make it look like the way you might think that it would.
Yep. I can agree with that.
Cool.
Yeah.
How about this as a LA movie?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, I mean, I just rewatched Inherent Vice a handful of weeks ago. A lot of it reminded me of that. Television cop that's also prominently involved in an investigation of some sort. LA being built up in a time that has since passed. And, I don't know, just a lot of confusion built around a mystery. And, yeah, I mean, they are both LA noir movies, so it kind of makes sense. But yeah, I enjoy it. I feel like LA movie is the type of genre I'm not, or a type of film that I'm not necessarily super attached to in general. The one thing I do always end up thinking about when I watch a bunch of 90s movies is that, oh yeah, like so many movies used to be shot in LA. Like almost too many movies were shot in LA at the time. And people are, semi-famously when La La Land was in the midst of its theatrical run, people were like, people don't make movies in Los Angeles anymore, so it's nice to see them do that here. And I'm just like, they just used to do it way too much, you know. It used to be a crutch. So I can't say that I'm too invested in the LA aspects of this movie. Yeah.
Well, it's
cool the way that it ties into history, just in the way that I'm interested in history of large cities, and especially the seedier aspects of the history of large cities. But as far as it being LA specific, I would say I'm not super, super into that aspect of the movie.
Right. Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's the same year as Boogie Nights and Jackie Brown, too.
Oh, yeah.
You have so many LA movies coming out in the 90s. Yeah. I think some of it ties in with noir, though, just because, I mean, a lot of the famous noir movies were set in L.A. as well, but just some of the, again, some of the themes that we deal with about celebrity and about identity, I think it played with really well here. And it's, you know, as you talk about interesting time for the history of cities and the seedier side of cities, it's, you know, post-war, 1950s L.A., and television's just really getting big. And it's kind of, you know, they talk about LAPD being the greatest police force in the world, and I think that the media here is just kind of popping up in a way, and we see this obviously very much with Hush Hush Magazine, that this world that's been talked about and been mythologized is now being depicted in a real way. You know, we have the Badge of Honor television show, but then we also have Hush Hush, we have all the tabloid magazines, but we also have the newspapers. And Hush Hush, you know, if you're going to talk about the seedy sides of things, it's one that, it's just a magazine that focuses on the seediest side of what's supposed to be the most glamorous thing in the world, right? The LA culture. And I think that's a lot of what the opening narration is about.
Yeah, I hate the opening narration. I know, like, they have to set things up, but like immediately, because I hadn't seen this movie, I feel like I saw this movie once when I was in high school. And I mean, I definitely remember watching it in high school. I don't remember watching it a second time, is what I'm saying. And that opening couple minutes, like when I watched it again this week, I was just like, oh, this is not a good start. I know, like, you have a lot of table setting to do, but I don't know. My expectations were definitely lowered by that opening. Yeah.
Well, maybe that's what it's there for. No.
Maybe this movie's very mediocre, and Curtis Hanson just knew it. And then he's like in the editing room. He's like, oh, we got to throw something really bad up front.
Yeah, I've seen this movie a few times, and just watching it again, I will admit that I forgot about that narration, and it did the same thing for me. I was immediately ready for this movie to be worse than I remembered it, and it just setting up this idea of all these new kids coming to LA and you know, having the wool finally pulled off their eyes as to what the true nature of the place is. And that is a theme that's in here, but I think there's so much more going on that narration sets it up to be a lot more surface and a lot simpler than this movie ends up being.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I will say I feel less positively about this movie than you do, and I think, judging by the reception of this movie, than most people feel about it. I think it's a good movie. I'm not comfortable classifying it as a great movie. And I just feel like the things that are good about this movie, or really good about this movie, happen, and then there's also, like, it's a real fits and starts sort of movie. Like, sometimes something really good will happen, and sometimes something that I find kind of annoying will happen, and then it goes back to something really good and something a little too on the nose. And I don't know, I just feel like the experience of watching this movie today, to me, is just a very up and down experience, which is partially the way that partially related to the blurring of the lines between popular media and reality that have, you know, happened in the 20 years that have passed since this movie was released. I'm sure I would feel differently about this movie in 1997 than I do today. But I just feel like that aspect of the movie hasn't helped it age well, you know? And I don't know, there's something about this movie that just feels too workmanlike all throughout. And there's just a certain flair about it that is missing to sort of keep everything together for me. Yeah.
Okay. What aspect do you think hurts it? It's the depiction of reality.
Well, some of the stuff with the, you know, real life interacting with media, some of the Jack Van Sinn stuff, some of the Danny DeVito stuff is a little too on the nose. I'm not just talking about that aspect of the movie. I'm talking about all of the scenes with Bud and Lynn are so boring to me. Yeah. Like, just unfathomably boring. And I understand why they are there. They are there to be the old classical romance sort of thing, just sort of a more vulgar way, in that we actually see them having sex. We hear cursing. We actually see, you know, a more realistic depiction of violence against women in this movie than you do when somebody just, a man just slaps a woman in the 50s. And it's just like, oh, that's just a thing that happens, you know? But I found all of those scenes tremendously boring. And those are the scenes that really don't fit in with the idea that we want to make this 1950s movie feel like it's not the 1950s. Because those scenes don't feel like they have to exist in the movie in the 1990s version. You know what I mean? And so that all detracts from the overall feeling of the movie. And, you know, I'm understanding of the idea that there are not a ton of them, but the things in this movie that are bad stick out so much to me. I mean, I think one of the worst moments in any movie ever is when Bud is revealed to still be alive at the end of this movie. I hated that so deeply when I first saw it, and then forgot about it, and was just like, after the gunfight, I was like, okay, Bud's dead. He came back. It was so upset. Like, that is so garbage and so lazy, and it just really felt like a moment where they shot two versions and weren't confident enough to commit to one on set. They're just like, we can't figure it. I can't decide if we want to kill this guy or not. So we got to cover our asses in case it doesn't work in the editing room. And I don't know. It just, those are the things that really stick out in this movie to me. And there's just a bunch of little things throughout otherwise.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's fine. And I agree with the Bud thing. 100%.
It's the worst.
Yeah. So, okay. So there's a few things there. I think that with the Bud's death thing, I think it's more they wanted one more misdirect in this movie, which is full of misdirects. And I mean this in, you know, the most obvious sense that any movie where you're trying to unravel this really complicated murder drug plot that Dudley Smith is involved in, there's going to be misdirects. There's going to be red herrings. They're going to be chasing the wrong guy at some point. You know, that just happens, right? Mm-hmm. But there are some other, there are some more misdirects that are kind of done visually that I do like a lot. When you know two of Mickey Cohen's lieutenants are about to be killed and they get into their car, you just assume it's going to be a car bomb.
Yeah.
At least that's how I always feel about that. And he starts the car and nothing happens. And then, you know, a second later, they just get shot up.
Yep.
That's a misdirect I really like.
Yeah, no, I like that as well, and had the same assumption as you when they sat down in the car. Yeah.
And so there's a bunch of, you know, there's just examples of things like that that I think are done well, these misdirects that really add. And I think this movie just wanted to have one more. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a terrible choice. Like, I think it's awful for a few different reasons.
Yeah.
But I think you kind of get the feeling that, you know, Lynn and Ed Exley are going to get together and, you know, they kind of pull a fast one on you, and Ed's fate is kind of unclear now. And I think the interesting notion of not really knowing what's going to happen to Exley is interesting. I just feel the way they go about it is, as you feel, just really underhanded and poor.
Yes. Yeah, you can't throw, like, you can still have the things what you're talking about where you feel like Ed and Lynn are going to get together at the end of the movie. You can still have her drive off. Bud doesn't have to be alive for that to happen.
Right.
So, you know, I just think it's so hacky, you know? And, like, I don't know, at that point, point of the movie is, you know, definitely the exhale moment of the movie. That's when, you know, things are wrapping up and you saw him shoot James Cromwell in the back. That's the ending, the ending of the action, and you're just sort of like, now we get to figure out the very brief wrap up for this story, and throwing another twist in there, it's the wrong time. The timing just doesn't work, you know.
Yep.
So.
Oh no, I'm with you. And if we're going to talk about the things I
it's too cute, too soon to the end, or too close to the end. You
know? Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Agreed. Another similar moment that just feels, you know, a little too on the nose, a little too old school in the wrong way, is when Exley's carrying his box of stuff down the aisle. And he's wearing his vest and he's whistling and he gets the box knocked out of his hand and everyone laughs. That's another moment that I think can be handled much differently and to much better effect. You know, I think the plot element has to be there of how disliked he is, but I think that one just seems to have been done so many times and the exact same way that I really dislike that part.
Yeah, it briefly turns into a 1950s teen movie as opposed to a cop movie. Yeah,
a very adult cop movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, speaking of things seeming dated, I think, you know, when you were talking about the Bud stuff being kind of a callback to that era in filmmaking, it always seems to me like Ed Exley should be the most dated and out of place character. Mm-hmm. You know, he's so optimistic and just this moral absolutist with, you know, none of the moral ambiguity that we've come to love in cinema quite clearly. And it just seems like he should be the one that seems out of place in a modern feeling movie. And I think you're right. I mean, I think Bud's the one, and Bud's kind of whole plot line is the thing that feels really old and not in a good way. And I think Exley's character actually feels a lot more dynamic and realistic than what it probably could have been on paper, right?
Yeah, exactly, because he's basically Clark Kent, but he's treated in a way that the real world would look at Clark Kent. They would be like, no, this isn't real. You know, like there's something that you are hiding from us. There's a secret layer to why you are doing this. Cause I think this movie in general, sort of comes from the worldview that pretty much everybody is self-interested all the time. And even the most, seemingly idealistic or, sorts of people, the Clark Kent types of people, have a reason for doing that exists purely to help them advance in their careers or their lives, you know? And yeah. So it's not so much the, yeah, you're right. That type of character seems like it would be dated. It would be like sort of a Leave It to Beaver guest star sort of thing. but the way that the movie looks at Ed is how it changes things, because, you know, the way that other characters talk about him, they're always suspicious about his worldview.
Yeah. Yeah, when he snitches, it's not, no one thinks it's because it's the right thing to do. It's because they assume he's getting something out of it. And I think that is one of the ways that this movie doesn't pigeonhole him like that, is because, yes, he is super idealistic, and he, throughout this movie, except maybe shooting his captain in the back, which I'm sure we'll get to later, he really always does the right thing. I mean, maybe not talking to Lana Turner that way, but seemingly he does the right thing. But quickly we see him doing this political maneuvering, you know, moving his chess pieces around, suggesting they kind of blackmail Vincennes with his Badge of Honor technical advisor role. Yep. In order, you know, like, he still is kind of this clever, calculating guy, even while doing seemingly the Boy Scout act, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
How about the talk of his glasses?
Okay, so let's talk about... I think this is the perfect example for me to talk about, like, one of the things I love about this movie, and then how it immediately turns into one of the things I hate about this movie. Okay. So the character introductions of this movie, I feel that this movie is all about how... I mean, it's kind of... feels kind of cheap to say this movie is all about perspective and how people look at things, because that's what all movies are about in some aspect, but this movie, you know, more than most, is about how various characters are looking at the worlds that they're in and how they're looking at each other, and also how we look at those character types, like how we see Ed Exley and how other characters see Ed Exley as this person that, like, is projecting this image of you know, he's an idealist and he does everything the right way, but we all know that there's something happening there that's different, right? So the three characters, or the three main characters, get introduced in very interesting ways. I'm gonna go out of order. It goes Bud, Ed, and Jack, but I'll start with Jack. So Jack is
I didn't mention K-Spay yet.
Oh, I love and adore Kevin Spacey in almost every one of his roles, and he is fantastic in this movie because he's Kevin Spacey. Oh, especially, yeah, like 90s Kevin Spacey. That's the best era.
Some great face work. But anyway,
oh, I don't want to such distract. Great face work. So, okay, so I guess I'll do Bud first, because Bud's the best character introduction. So he's sitting in a car with Stenz in the back, already drunk, waiting to get to the party, and you know, they're just looking into this house. Yes, exactly. Looking into this house that, you know, standard suburban house, Christmas lights, it's Christmas time, it's Christmas Eve, and this man is assaulting his wife. And what is happening is, you know, Bud is sitting outside of this house, this sort of ideal-looking suburban house. It's just a normal-looking house for a family that probably does okay, you know, middle-class family with Christmas decorations and everything. And he can see what is really happening inside, partially because they don't have blinds, but also because he's willing to look. So what he does is he gets out of the car and he rips down some of the Christmas decorations, right? He tears down the facade of this idealism and brings the guy that was assaulting his wife outside. And then he handcuffs him to a railing, tells the cops that this is worth coming to check out. And then he also lifts up the Christmas decoration like it's caution tape of a crime scene to get to help the wife leave the scene. And so that scene is great. That's the best scene in the movie to me, because it really encapsulates everything about the good things about this movie, and that it's about how these different characters view the world that they are in. And so I really like that, and the fact that they're using Christmas decorations so interestingly is really cool as well. So then we get to Jack, and I'll get back to Ed after, but we've got Jack at a Badge of Honor party. He's just dancing with somebody. He's not really looking around. He's just sort of comfortable. He's just like, whatever, I'm just existing. He doesn't really bother to look, because he is the person that is the least least good cop, I guess, of the three at the beginning of the movie. And he does, you know, he does sort of have a change of heart throughout the movie, and starts to actually get involved in the investigation. But at this point in the movie, he is not looking around. He's just dancing. He's doing random movements with the with a woman who he's trying to have sex with, because that's what he views as more important than justice. And so,
and he doesn't even see Mr. Hush Hush enter, because he's not looking around, right?
Exactly. He just doesn't care. You know, it's just, he only cares about himself. He doesn't care to look at other people in the room, you know? And even the woman that he is talking to, he's talking to for purely self-interested reasons. So then we've got Exley in the middle. We've got him outside of, Captain Dudley Smith. He's giving like a toast to the troops or whatever, but Exley is outside of this room, and he is looking at this group of cops that that he is far removed from, and he's being interviewed by the media, but he's still looking at this group that he is not a part of. And so he's seeing this other world, but he sees it, and as we pick up throughout the movie, he sees it as a more corrupt version of a world of just like than just people standing around sharing a drink on Christmas Eve. He knows that there's some corruption happening here, and you know, later in that evening, bad things are going to happen at that police station. But he's still like this lonely man looking at the world he is trying to be a part of. Like, he's totally separated from them. And he will continue to be. And then pretty much immediately, James Cromwell starts talking about his glasses and how he's pretty sure there's nobody else in the bureau that wears them. Like, that's just so garbage. Like, just have him have glasses and be the only person with glasses, the only person that sees things for what they are. Don't mention them like four different times in the movie. It's terrible, you know?
Yeah. And he says he has the eyes to be a detective, but not the stomach.
Ugh. So hack. So like, those are things that I really like about this movie. The character introductions portion of this movie, I think, is the strongest stuff. But that it's so quickly undermined in one important case, you know, it's just it makes it so problematic for me.
Yeah, that's fair. I didn't even see that much in the Bud White introduction, but I think it's a good read on that.
Yeah, and there's also another, just tying into the Christmas decoration thing. Like, Jack is later, when they're in the jail cell and they're beating up these perpetrators. Jack isn't a part of the fight or whatever, and then one of the people that Bud was beating up bleeds on him, and he's like, oh no, you got blood on my outer facade, my facade of stylishness, now I'm fighting, you know, like, you can't touch this sort of thing.
Seems, I mean, we're supposed to really dislike the cops for what they're doing at this point. You know, they're certainly acting outside of proper protocol, but at least some of those cops got told that, you know, these arrested people did these horrible things to their coworkers, and, you know, they're taking out their rage on them. Again, that's not a good thing to do. It's not proper protocol, but it's at least not, entirely selfish in a way. I know that sounds bad, but Jax is just, you got blood on my coat. You know what I mean? It's entirely self-interested. Again, they're all acting in a terrible way, but his is just entirely out of motivation on his appearance. So, yeah, that to speak about his appearance and about his facade, I think, is very very on point there. He does turn, but he is a lovable dick for a while, though.
Oh yeah,
like, when he comes back from his suspension and just gives everyone that face.
Oh, it's so good.
Something about that just kills me.
Yeah, because Kevin Spacey is a deeply likable person.
Yeah. And also with that that dance number that Danny DeVito walks in on, it's just the fact that his face is just at breast height of a woman that size, and we're just trying to depict him as the sleaziest character that we could come up with, I think works out so well. It's such a happy accident.
Yeah, absolutely. And Danny DeVito is also, just as an actor, the perfect person for this role, you know? Even outside of physical reasons, like, he just nails this part.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what you were saying about the physical stature aspect, like, Danny DeVito is perfect for his part as a performer, and also physically. James Cromwell is also perfect for his part as a performer and physically, because he towers over everybody in this movie, because James Cromwell is like 6'4" or whatever, and he is, what he's trying to do is also tower over the city of Los Angeles, you know. So just sort of just through, without the use of apple boxes, just like a happy accident, James Cromwell is a tall person, so he just happens to tower over everybody in this movie.
And Danny DeVito's a moral midget, very fitting for a character.
What about
Exley wearing his glasses less as the movie progresses? And maybe him removing them for the picture that needs to be taken and doing that pose with his face, which is also wonderful. I don't care what you say about it.
No, that moment's actually good. I like that moment because they don't tell me what to think. But the as far as him wearing his glasses less throughout the movie, yes, I'm fine with that. It's just when characters address it with dialogue, that's when it's annoying. Because the glasses thing is something that I would have picked up on watching this movie. And as is a common theme throughout so many of these podcasts, anytime I feel like a movie is talking down to me, I get angry because I don't like being treated like a dumb person. So that's what the Captain Smith line, "I don't know anybody else in the bureau who wears them," is. It's just, it makes me feel like a second grader, and this is a movie that's allegedly being made for adults, you know, so treat me like one.
Yeah, that's fair. But you do like when he takes them off for the picture? Why?
Oh, it's just that that's just a quiet moment of him caring about his own image, and that's also a moment where he doesn't need to see, so it's fine. You know, it's not annoying to me in the way that I don't know, as somebody that has worn glasses or contact lenses for the vast majority of my life, it's always been weird to me how people care more about how people look at them than whether or not they can actually see the world. So that's just sort of my own shit. It's just like, just wear the glasses because then you can see. and then you can better see the people in front of you and then like pick them apart mercilessly with all the extra details you can see with your 20/20 vision. But him taking off the glasses, that's him constructing his own image. He's not being told to take off the glasses. It's just like, an image is being captured of me. I want to be seen as a person that doesn't wear glasses. Yeah,
and I think he, you know, he's a smart guy. And yeah, he understands perception. And
especially that, like in the 50s, like it was just such a different thing, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, to tie back into the media stuff a little bit, it's at a time when the depictions of police work were shows like, you know, Dragnet, or I guess in the LA Confidential cinematic universe, Badge of Honor, and newspaper footage, you know, and sometimes like we see at, you know, Bloody Christmas, there are more candid pictures, but a lot of the times it's a relationship, a symbiotic relationship between police officers and the media. You know, if you want a scoop, then you can depict us in a better light. And obviously we see that so much with Vincennes and Hush Hush Magazine, and you know, just exchanging access for positive representation. And this is a time before, you know, cell phone videos and YouTube and police body cams and stuff like that, and it's them, you know, forming the public perception of them, making very deliberately making an image, and that's, I find that runs through. And some of the stuff that we do see with Hush Hush Magazine is more the beginning of sensationalism, and you know, we see the arrests kind of staged with the movie premiere in the background, but we also see the kind of celebrity expose angle of Hush Hush Magazine, where, you know, they're getting dirt against people's wishes, and that's why that woman doesn't want to dance with him, because he says things that, you know, may be true, may not be true, but that are done in a sensationalist way, and just kind of, you know, being a rag magazine, just kind of getting whatever you can out there to try to get readers, try to get money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you want to talk any more about Bud and Lynn, or is it just too infuriating for you?
No, I'm fine to talk about it. I mean, I'm not going to say anything positive about their scenes together. So, like, if you're looking for compliments, then no. Apologies to Brian Helgeland, who may or may not be listening. Probably is. Everybody listens to our podcast. I don't know. Do you have anything that you enjoyed about those scenes?
Yeah, I would say I do, and I think that you know, I think if your read of it is correct, that this is kind of a bit of a 50s throwback moment, that to make a movie about this time period, they should shoot a little bit of the spirit of, you know, the movies that were being made at that time. And that's what that scene is, or their scenes together for the most part is. I think that's correct. I feel the same way about it, but to a less strong degree. Mm-hmm. I think it doesn't fit in and probably hurts things overall. And yeah, I mean, to make a modern movie and to still have, I mean, modern 1997, mm-hmm. But obviously modern at the time, to have these characters fall in love just over looks, you know, it's so flat and it's so bad and it's so antithetical to, I think, a lot of the better parts about modern filmmaking and depicting relationships accurately, and that you actually have to get to know someone and spend time with each other, and that a woman has more of a personality than just her outward appearance. I think all that's true, and I think we're largely on the same page with all that. But I do like the scene when he goes over there and she's spending time with the councilman, which brings another very funny line out of this movie. Mm-hmm. When he leaves and Bud says, "Bye, councilman," he says, "Bye, officer." That's very funny to me.
Yeah, that is funny.
I really do like a lot of the stuff that's in there, and not for the reasons that it's kind of, you know, era appropriate. I like the big wide shot they take of her rolling up the screen that they'd been projecting the film on.
Okay.
And then it exposing, you know, the rest of her apartment. It's kind of this wider shot that we don't get a ton of in this movie. You know, it's almost her whole apartment, or at least half of it, you know, but it's wall to wall. Well, to wall, I guess. And we have this movie that's been playing there, and then the screen disappears, it gets rolled up, and then we have reality. But the way that it's shot, you know, it's very symmetrical, it's very wide. It kind of sets up the apartment as a set, as a stage. And it's this area where she acts. You know, she's not Veronica Lake, but she still will be an actress. You know, she plays her part as Pratchett wants her to play. And, you know, she kind of plays Bud, she plays Exley, she does what needs to be done of her. You know, she's not just a prostitute to bring home money, but again, another one of these chess pieces in this grand scheme that's going on in Los Angeles at this time. And I really do enjoy that. I think that's done maybe not subtly, but not ham-fistedly the way I think some of the other problems you have with this movie are. And it's one of the times in the movie that we get the most camera movements that I noticed. You know, you said we have Steadicam, but we kind of get these larger sweeps, you know, into medium shots or close-ups and things like that. And there's just the motivated camera movements and the framing of the shots in that scene really remind me of the performative nature of what she does. And even though we don't know exactly all of that at that time, upon rewatch, we kind of get more of that, you know, cinematic performative aspect to her character. And that's something that I think is done well. And the first few times, some of those camera movements stick out to me, because although there is some throughout this movie, and it's not as though the camera's static, but it's these really noticeable ones. They kind of stick out, but when we know the whole plot and we can kind of place it within this criminal enterprise and the role that she plays and kind of ends up shaking off, I really do like that part. Does any of that work for you? Or?
Yeah, I mean, that scene of their scenes, like, that's the one I have no problem with, because that scene is more is primarily about the case, you know?
Yeah.
And features so much less of their, you know, it's not them going to the movies, which is deeply annoying. that scene actually has something going on that I enjoy. And even the romance aspect of the movie features of that scene features something that I like, where Lynn says to Bud, he's the first person that doesn't say she looks like Veronica Lake within a minute. And that adds something to Bud's character, because Bud, again, like, he was able to see through the facade of the Christmas decorations in the suburban idealistic home, can see what is real. He can see that she is Lynn. She is not Veronica Lake, you know? And yeah. That is of their moments together, that's the one I like. And that is a scene that in general does not fit with what I've said about their romance aspects of this movie. Because that movie is sort of pre their romance.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it means that Exley shoots Dudley? And I mean, we have an exchange earlier in this movie, about 2 hours earlier, that talks about this exact same scenario. You know,
yeah.
Dudley asks Exley, would you shoot a hardened criminal in the back if you knew he was guilty, if it meant, and we don't get the end of the question because Exley is so adamant that that's not the way things are done, and therefore it's the way he would never do them.
Yeah.
Is this a significant change in Exley's character that he's willing to do it now?
I think he might have always been willing to do it, and it's just sort of when that conversation happens between Cromwell and Pierce, it's so early in the movie, we have just been introduced to Exley, that we are sort of taking everything at face value. We haven't learned to look past the facades yet, you know? Because I feel like in that scene especially, as somebody that didn't remember every beat of this movie, having not seen it in about 15 years, that at that scene I sort of took Exley at face value, because there hadn't been enough clues that, like, oh, you need to realize that he is self-interested, you know. Mm-hmm. Clark Kent doesn't exist, that's not a real person. So I think it's just he always had that in him. It was just as an audience we didn't know the proper way to look at him yet.
Okay,
that's my take on it. Yourself?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that's accurate. I don't think he changes that much between then and the beginning of the movie. I mean, he knows that Dudley Smith is the kind of guy who would do that kind of thing, who would frame somebody. I just think he sees him as just as bad as the rest of the LAPD, which is not absolutely terrible, but is willing to take these shortcuts, you know, to ensure that guilty people go away. And I think by the end of it, he learns that Dudley Smith's character is far beyond that. He isn't just planting drugs at a known drug dealer's house just to, you know, solidify the case against him. He's trying to run drugs. He's, you know, in cahoots with prostitution and drug dealing and, you know, murder for hire and all these awful things. And I just think that this is Dudley Smith at the end of that movie before he gets shot in the back is about to continue everything. You know, it's not as though that there's going to be a case against him and he's going to go away. Exley doesn't need to would be happy to see Dudley Smith go to jail for the rest of his life, but he knows that that's not going to be the case. And I think he believes that the problems are too big and too institutional that if he doesn't end Dudley Smith's run right then and there, it's going to continue and it might even become powerful enough to swallow Exley up. And that this is him kind of being backed in a corner, not doing something he knew he would never be capable of doing, but just being put in a position that this option really is in line with his morals and what he feels compelled to do.
Yep. Okay. I can see that.
Cool. What else do you want to say about
he doesn't want Dudley Smith to tower over LA like he's been towering over Exley.
No, even for all the whiskey in Ireland, he wouldn't do. there is some beauty noir dialogue in this, though.
Oh, for sure. It's an entertaining movie, yeah.
Yeah, and it I mean, that all the whiskey in Ireland line kind of makes me laugh, but I think it is easy to try to lean into noir territory and have it come off really campy really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I feel they do a better job of this than you do. But I, for the most part, with some of the exceptions that we've already listed, I think that they come close to a cliff that's easy to fall off without falling off of it for the most part.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that is the writing, but also, again, you look at the cast list of this movie and it's just pretty much top to bottom great. I don't think Kim Basinger is very good in this movie, but everybody else is great. Part of that is also my disdain for Lynn as a character, or just total lack of interest in her. But, you know, like, as we discussed, pretty much everybody in this movie, if you don't know their name, you at least recognize them from something else, you know? Ron Rifkin's a great example of somebody that everybody has seen in some sort of cop movie from the 90s who's good in everything, but yeah. Nobody knows who Ron Rifkin is, you know? Except unless you were maybe, like, a super fan of Alias. I think he was the CIA director on that show. But yeah, it's just a well-cast movie filled with very talented character actors. Yeah. And that sort of helps sell some of those lines that may or may not have been able to be pulled off with a lesser performer.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So this movie, I mean, it made a good amount of money. It nine Oscar nominations, a lot of very good critical reviews. And I didn't know this, but the National Society of Film Critics, the New York Film Critics, the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and the National Board of Review all voted it the best movie of the year.
Okay.
Which has only ever been done by Schindler's List or The Social Network.
Okay.
Callback to The Social Network.
my whole life is a callback to The Social Network. Everything like after 2010 is me calling back to The Social Network. But anyway, continue.
Yeah. And obviously, it lost a lot of those nominations to Titanic, and you know, I wouldn't say that these movies are going for the exact same audience, but I think it's fair to say that even just off those nominations alone, that maybe this movie was overshadowed by that a little bit. Why don't I ever hear about this movie anymore? What is it just me, or is this kind of fallen by the wayside? And is it for the reasons that you don't like this movie?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just, I mean, we talked about it last week with Buster Keaton. So few movies actually continue like their life, like they still exist in the culture for 20 plus years. You know, so few movies do, and this just didn't make the cut. You know, like something in the way that people watch movies is that this wasn't one that people wanted to watch and rewatch, and didn't want to quote your noir-y lines that you love so much in the way that Life is Like a Box of Chocolates or whatever from Forrest Gump has continued to exist. I don't know. I think it's more along the lines of just so few movies have that staying power, especially as we get further and further away from the way film was treated in the 90s compared to now, 20 years later, film is just so much less important to culture, you know, just because there are just been so many advances in what kind of television shows and I don't know, web content and everything that you can have. There's just fewer movies are going to survive, and fewer movies have survived because fewer people are still watching and talking about movies. You know, nobody's going to the video store and scanning the mystery shelves on a Tuesday and then just happening upon being like, oh yeah, I want to watch LA Confidential again anymore. You know, that just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I agree that even 10 years ago, there were other things fighting for people's eyeballs besides what Hollywood puts out. But, I mean, it's got 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, but I feel like even 10 years ago that this movie just didn't stick at all. And I think I'm trying to figure out why this is a tight, I mean, in my opinion, seemingly a lot of critical opinion, this is a tight, well-respected movie that, is it just because it doesn't say anything that it keeps it in the conversation, or does it not have that iconic moment or that iconic line?
Definitely doesn't have an iconic moment or an iconic line. It is also a big part of it is that Russell Crowe is kind of the star of this movie. Like him and Guy Pearce are sort of on the same level. People just don't like Russell Crowe. Like as a person. So, yeah. And I say this as a Russell Crowe fan, as a fan of his performances and less so of him throwing phones at concierges. But, that's a big part of it. And you know, even Kevin Spacey, that's not enough. People like Kevin Spacey, but people aren't going out of their way to see Kevin Spacey movies, you know? And Guy Pearce is basically nothing to the common person. So
everyone has momentum syndrome when it comes to Guy Pearce.
So it's just, it lacks a couple of things, and just as a movie, like I was saying about it sometimes feeling too workmanlike, and that lack of an iconic moment, all of those combine into something that just doesn't work. Like what you said about it being nominated for 9 Academy Awards, and just being critically well reviewed. There's like 5 of those movies every year, and one of them gets remembered typically. Yeah. So,
and it was Titanic.
So yeah, the lesson is always is fuck James Cameron. I mentioned Public Enemies earlier in this podcast. I just sort of looked it up to confirm a suspicion, and Public Enemies has the same cinematographer as LA Confidential, which I enjoyed, because it is another period piece that is shot not like a period piece. And one thing I did want to address is that we haven't talked about the aspects of the movie that some of the things that I find the most interesting about this movie are sort of the more things change, the more they stay the same sort of situation, and that so many things are being looked at idealistically throughout this movie. Even if we're just looking at it's a very brief moment, the announcement of the Los Angeles freeway, you know, it's just like from the beach to Santa Monica in 30 minutes. And I've never been to Los Angeles, but everything popular media has told me is that that's a lie. And what the apparently like the version of the freeway that they were pitching ended up being this madness traffic situation that can only be made positive by dance numbers that could never happen in like in La La Land. So like just these little things, and I like the way that the movie sort of shows us the fleur-de-lis, the prostitutes that look like celebrities. I enjoyed that as a thematic aspect of this movie that we haven't really talked about, just the way that
that's great.
Yeah, for sure. And as somebody that has been listening to the Father John Misty record a lot, the new one, where that stuff is all throughout it, like the first lyric to the second song is betting Taylor Swift inside the Oculus Rift, or every night inside the Oculus Rift, which is a wonderful lyric. And just sort of that romantic attachment to celebrity that can almost never actually, in the case of this movie, it can't actually really be physical, just because you are looking at these people as if they are sort of this idealistic version, and then you are meeting a real version of this person, even if you do get to meet Taylor Swift or whatever, you know, it's just not, she's not the person that you have imagined, because she is a person, you know, because no person can be what you imagine them to be. I enjoy that. And the maybe one of the things I really like about the end of this movie is the depiction of the Los Angeles Police Department. As Exley and Lynn are leaving his Medal of Valor ceremony, the very end, I forget who says it, but somebody at the podium says, you know, next year we'll be getting our brand new headquarters, and there will be no more image of the fat cop stealing apples, or whatever weird choice of phrasing he uses. And just like Los Angeles will finally have the police department it deserves. This movie came out like 4 years after the LA riots. And yeah. I just think that that is a really great, very small moment to throw into this movie that really fits along the lines of the more things change, the more they stay the same. You know, it's just sort of this, you know, we've got this idealistic look of the LAPD, but let's look back in the very recent history. If you're in the movie theater watching this movie, and you don't have to go too far back to be like, oh yeah, the LAPD sucks, you know? And there are lots of little things like that throughout the movie where there are just like throwaway lines that do add a nice aspect to this movie. It's just, to these eyes, the movie is just too up and down to sort of be something that I think is great. But I will say it's a very good movie, and the gunfight at the end is very good, as is the one that ends with Exley shooting the guy in the elevator.
Yeah, and I think the big kind of you know, movie long example of the more things change, the more they stay the same, is that Mickey Cohen, you know, gets sent to jail. Mm-hmm. You know, at the start of the you know, in the first 5 minutes of this movie, we are introduced to this massive drug kingpin, and he's incarcerated, right?
Yeah.
If it's good enough for Al Capone, it's good enough for Mickey C. He's off to jail for tax evasion. I mean, and what fills the power vacuum is the exact institution that's meant to prevent someone like Mickey Cohen from getting to the size he is, right?
Yeah.
He's a criminal kingpin who ends up being removed and replaced by law enforcement agencies. And I don't think there's a better example of this notion that there's always going to be someone or something to fill in all those negative aspects of society. And there's no better example of it than being the complete opposite, or, you know, what's supposed to be the most antithetical, counterintuitive force to a criminal is exactly who ends up filling his shoes. So I think that's the theme that you bring up in a nutshell, done perfectly in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week, where we'll be talking about something else.